You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, Turkey comes face to face with the Islamic State as the battle on the border continues to rage.
This is a town that is literally on the Turkish border, and so we have one of, you know, the largest fighting forces in the NATO alliance, the Turkish military, on the sidelines watching this town fall.
Our guests Sabrina Shackle and Kathleen Burke give us their take on the latest developments. They'll also weigh in on the media frenzy around the spread of Ebola as Liberia limits access for journalists covering the crisis. Our Brazil correspondent brings us views from voters after the Brazilian election goes to a second vote.
I feel that nowadays everything in Brazilian politics is more or less the same.
I'm going to vote for our president, for Dilma. I liked her government, so I'm going to repeat my vote.
We'll also look at the underground graphic art movement and put you in the picture with a roundup of the best exhibitions in London right now. That is all to come on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Dilma Rousseff has won the most votes in Brazil's presidential elections, but will have to win a second runoff poll if she's to serve another term in office. She got around 42% of the vote, ahead of the centre-right rival Aécio Neves, who got 34%. The critical factor in the runoff will be what happens to the 1 in 5 voters who supported the Socialist Party candidate Marina Silva, who is now out of the race. As the polls opened, many voters remain undecided.
For president, I think it's Aécio who's going to win. I don't think Marina has what it's necessary to run a country. And Dilma, no way. We need to take her out.
I feel that nowadays everything in Brazilian politics is more or less the same.
A residential area close to Ukraine's Donetsk International Airport has been hit by return fire from the Ukrainian military today. At least one person, said to be a local resident, was killed by the shelling. While fighting in much of eastern Ukraine has been calmed by a month-old truce, it rages unabated at the Donetsk airport and neighbouring areas. More than 3,500 people have died in the conflict, according to the United Nations. Civil servants in Hong Kong have returned to work at government buildings as pro-democracy protests in the territory subside. Hundreds of demonstrators remain on the streets, but far fewer than the thousands seen last week. Hong Kong's government had warned police would restore order if the protests didn't end. Paul Tsai is a member of Hong Kong's Legislative Council.
Although the situation is somewhat improved this morning in the sense that people can be allowed to walk through to the office buildings, but then again, all the vehicles are blocked and it's very difficult for the more senior officials to come through to work.
Workers at Israel's state-owned Haifa port went on strike on Monday, shutting one of the major trade gateways over a government plan to build private competing ports. Nearly all of Israel's exports and imports are transported by ship, making the port workers' union among the most powerful in the country. Tensions have been high in recent years over government plans to open 2 privately run ports along the Mediterranean next to Ashdod, which is also state-run, and Haifa in the coming years. People who suffered under the rule of Jean-Claude Duvalier in Haiti say his death has robbed them of justice. The former dictator died over the weekend after suffering a heart attack. Almost 3 decades after being forced out of office, a court ruled this year that Duvalier could face trial for crimes against humanity. Now Robert Duval, abused during the dictatorship, says no one will be held accountable for scores of murders, torture and disappearances.
Now that he's dead, he's gone, then you know he cannot be prosecuted, and that's a shame for this country, because he is this criminal, the dictator that is gone, and he didn't pay really for his crime.
And finally, in the United States, a Washington state mother may be forced to pay nearly $700 after bouncing a $30 check to pay for her two children's high school lunches, school and debt collection officials have said. Christina Johnson Connolly bounced a check to pay for the equivalent of about 10 lunches at the North Thurston High School in Lacey, which is 55 miles south of Seattle. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back with more news headlines in about 25 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we are back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Berlin.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are freelance journalists Samira Shackle and Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern History at University College London. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start today's discussion with a look at latest developments in the so-called caliphate established by the Islamic State, which has been engaged in heavy fighting with the Kurdish army on the Turkey-Syria border. Kurdish Peshmerga forces say they have retaken an area outside the town of Kobani, while the IS has raised its black flag on a building on its outskirts. Some local officials have estimated that Kobani might fall to Islamic State fighters soon. Kathleen, if I may start with you, what is your impression on the whole? How much actual impact have the US airstrikes actually had?
It's hard to tell over here. I mean, on the one hand, you get reports from the U.S. saying they knocked out two fighters or they hit a gun emplacement. So presumably something is happening in that sense. But the effect on the ground has been not very obvious. That is to say, they hear a plane coming. They leave the guns. They race and hide. And then when the plane goes over, they come back. And shoot the guns seems to be what's happening. So it doesn't seem to me, although it interdicted a lot to start with, supply trains, convoys and so forth, it seems to be in diminishing returns right now.
Samira, Peshmerga forces have complained of poor coordination between coalition forces and fighters on the ground. Do you think this is yet another example of bad planning on the part of the Americans?
I think it's, as Kathleen says, it's quite difficult to say without actually being on the ground. But I think certainly whenever you're dealing with the sort of strategy that the US and its partners have decided to take is a combination of airstrikes and supporting, sort of working with local partners like the Kurds, for instance, and strengthening those forces. And I think whenever you're dealing with those many different layers of strategy, of interaction, of different actors, I think there are always going to be problems. And I think the return to ground troops, which is what people are talking about, which is what the Syrian Kurds are calling for today, would probably be pretty politically unviable in the US and the UK to say we're going back in with ground troops. I mean, President Obama's explicitly ruled that out. So I think that the principle of working to strengthen local partners and supporting them from the air is a good one. But I think, as we've seen today, it's not certainly not a magical answer.
Well, except that two things. First of all, President Obama, of course, said there wasn't going to be any bombing either. Mm-hmm. It's a foolish, foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. And the other thing, of course, is that both in, particularly in the United States, one begins to see an incremental growth in support for ground forces, including especially in the Republicans, so that I would not wipe it out entirely. We're finding it over here in Britain as well. That even, I mean, what can you say? President Obama can't say, I'm going to go in and throw your young men and we're going to get those. He's not Ronald Reagan. He's not a Lyndon Johnson. He doesn't want to fight. But it doesn't seem that the air strikes are doing what he hoped and promised they would do. And it looks as though there's a slowly growing tide of actually putting in more forces.
Kathleen, can I just make a point? There does seem to be some sort of disagreement between the Kurds and the US about how much impact these strikes are actually having. What does that tell us?
It tells us that they want more strikes, I should have thought. I don't know. I think people thought that when America was going to come into it, somehow there'd be a magical transformation. What they need to do is magically transform Turkey, I think, which it says it's not going to let this town fall. And unless something's happened in the past 3 or 4 hours, of which I know nothing, nothing has happened yet in Turkey. The United States is not a genie out of a bottle. It can only do what people on the ground will support that it do when the push comes to shove. And Peshmerga wants, what they want, of course, is they want arms and they want supplies, and they want them dropped in the middle of Kobani. Well, that's also a prescription for getting shot down.
You already mentioned Turkey over there. Turkey voted last week to provide military assistance in Iraq, and we are now hearing that there are Turkish tanks on the border with Syria. Samira, do you think we could expect any kind of ground action from Turkey?
Again, it's difficult to say, I think, without having a crystal ball. But certainly with incursions being made on the border, Kobani, that's a significant thing for Turkey. There was also news today about a big prisoner swap that Turkey, it's not been completely verified, but you had British intelligence sources saying it was, that reports are credible that Turkey had swapped a whole load of prisoners in return for the 49 hostages that ISIS were holding. So it's certainly something that it's got a very close and immediate effect on Turkey. I think it shares a border. So I think that as Kathleen was saying, I do think that could have the potential to be quite an effective local partner there. So we'll see.
Kathleen, what do you think Turkey is thinking at the moment?
Well, the problem is the Kurds, isn't it? If they weren't Kurds, it wouldn't be so difficult. But they've been saying that Kurds in the south of Turkey have been terrorists for 30, 40, 50 years. And all of a sudden, the PKK, the Turkish People's Party, are now fighting in Syria. Kurdish areas. So what is Turkey going to do? It's obviously twisting, shall I say, getting its knickers in a twist? Because does it support the very people it's been condemning? But those people are one of the really important elements in the fighting. Turkey's going to have to make an executive decision here, and it will be very interesting to us who aren't involved what it's going to be.
And Samira, you already raised the other point of these reports published today that claim that two British jihadists have been among more than 100 prisoners freed back into the arms of ISIS by Turkey in order to secure the freedom of diplomats held hostage by the militant group. This deal supposedly involved a trade-off of as many as 180 ISIS fighters in return for these Turkish diplomats. Kathleen, what is your reaction first? I'm looking at your face there when you are thinking of listening to me.
Well, no, it's. Are you finding it interesting because British jihadists are involved, or because
the swap,
or because Turkey is willing to swap? Both, I suppose. Well, I'm surprised there's only two British jihadists involved in that. I think is my main reaction to that.
And Kath and Samira, yeah. What are your thoughts about this swap?
I think it's quite interesting, basically, that the different kinds of tactics that different countries are taking, and that's something that's been debated quite heavily over the last few weeks. You know, you've got Britain and the US that make no concessions. They have a very strict policy against ever paying ransoms. You have countries like France and Italy who do pay ransoms. I think they've sort of stopped now because the amounts of money that you're handing to ISIS is essentially allowing them to continue with building this proto-state. And you've got countries like Turkey, which apparently, if the reports today are true, are happy to swap prisoners. And it's all quite, it's very murky and very difficult, I think. And it can be quite hard to sort of unpack what the right thing to do is. And I guess somewhere like Turkey, perhaps, just wants to avoid that kind of public relations coup that it gives ISIS when you can behead a citizen. And I think what Kathleen was saying earlier about the public in the US incrementally supporting more military action, that's something that polls show also in the UK. And it's certainly not unconnected to the beheadings, because, you know, there's something very visceral and very shocking about it. It makes the violence very personal. And I think that that has a real impact impact overseas, and perhaps in engaging in a prisoner swap, Turkey sort of wants to deny the ability to make that sort of point.
Let's continue with other news. Now, the UN World Health Organization says Ebola has killed as many as 3,400 people in West Africa, and half of the almost 400 health workers infected have died. Scientists today estimated that there is a 75% chance the Ebola virus could spread to France and a 50% chance it could reach the UK by the end of this month. That is according to researchers who have analysed air traffic data to calculate the chances of someone arriving to Europe from an affected area. But how much is the coverage and global hype justified? In Liberia, the government has just limited access to journalists. It says the measures are needed to keep people safe. And in the US, the recent arrival of a Liberian man carrying the disease has sparked quite a media frenzy. So looking at the massive attention this one individual case in the US has been getting compared to what's going on in Africa. Samira, are we being hysterical, or is this the right way to deal with this topic?
Well, I think there's a distinction to be made, as you did, between Ebola in West Africa and Ebola in the US or the UK. And I think certainly there is a huge amount of hysteria about Ebola in the West. I mean, the likelihood is that it's probably not going to kill you. I mean, there was a case of the British nurse who was infected with Ebola, who came back, and he's made a full recovery. He's actually planning, I think, to go back to Sierra Leone to continue with his health work. Whereas, you know, in West Africa, you have literally thousands of people dying, not just thousands of people dying from Ebola, but also people dying from other entirely preventable diseases because the healthcare systems are so strained. So I think that there is a sort of disconnect between the fact that, yes, this is a death sentence if you contract it in a place where the epidemic is strongest and where healthcare systems are floundering. It's not necessarily a death sentence in the US or the UK. And also, it's a disease that's spread through the contact, through bodily fluids. You don't get it from the air. You don't get it, you know, it's so that the case, if there's one person in Dallas, I think it was, who's got Ebola, you're not going to catch it in San Francisco. And I think that perhaps some of the more sensationalist coverage hasn't really recognised that.
Kathleen, what are your thoughts when you are following the continuous reports on this topic and how the media is dealing with this story?
Oh, well, a whole concatenation of thoughts. I mean, first of all, the Ebola victim in the States has gone from serious to critical. Yeah. So he's certainly the very opposite of being out of danger. Reading about it today, especially the hospitals in the various African countries, people not wanting to go to hospital and so forth. That when you hear about what it's like there, you know, the things we know about one has to say, the lack of hygiene, the non-sterilized needles, it sort of reminds me of Victorian England, when if you went to a hospital, your chances of dying were rather better than if you stayed at home. And I do wonder whether the people who don't want to leave their houses actually factor in the idea they might be better off. And no one, since they don't know what causes it, they don't know they oughtn't to touch each other and so forth. The thing is as well is that it's not going to take over in France or Italy or Britain or the United States, because the Western industrialized countries have ability to impose controls, they've got quarantine, they can stop people at borders and so forth in ways that Africa can't. I'm glad Africa's being paid attention to. I don't care if it's a big mess, because people ought to know what it's like there, and it's sad that it takes this sort of crisis to make clear the whole lack of health care that's not available.
Journalists in Liberia say that the local government is trying to limit access to the front lines of the infection. Supposedly, this new media access policy aims to protect the privacy of patients and healthcare workers, as well as the health and safety of Liberian and international journalists. What does this sound like to you?
Well, it sounds like governments trying to protect themselves. One gathers that, in fact, this is a very much a turnaround to what has been the press freedom of the past 14 years, and that there is fear that there's going to be a sliding back to the sort of authoritarian situation that took place before the Civil War. What's really interesting is that people say, okay, photographers are saying, okay, we can't go to the hospitals, but so many people aren't in the hospitals. If we want to photograph victims, we can go to the houses. So the control, I think, is pretty porous at this point.
Samira, you are a journalist. Could you imagine putting yourself in this situation? First of all, why would you want to put yourself there and take a risk of actually getting Ebola?
Yeah, well, you've actually had the first foreign journalist recently has contracted Ebola. It was a cameraman for NBC. I think that's certainly true. I mean, I guess people do it because they want to report the story, I guess, and you know, it's important to get the information out. It's important to get awareness, but it always is that balance, I think, not just about personal safety, but also about ethics. And I think while this certainly is a case here of a government seeking to protect themselves and probably not wanting constant reporting about their floundering healthcare systems, I think there is also an ethical question about that. I mean, it's something that you always have to think about when reporting disasters, the privacy and dignity of victims. I know I have a friend actually who works as a freelance filmmaker in Liberia who had done a piece for a major network about Ebola, and was sort of getting editors sitting in the safety of a Western country saying, can you go back in? Can you get more graphic images? We want pictures. And she's saying, well, actually, no, I can't because of the huge risk that involves. So I think there's always a balance to be struck between getting the story out, reporting on it, and the ethics.
And do you think in this modern world it's actually realistic, and do you think it's actually doable to actually try to limit the excess of journalists from getting to these places?
I don't think that journalists should be limited from getting access to places. I mean, certainly you can make it harder, and I mean that's something I've come across, sort of come up against quite a lot working internationally as a journalist. You know, like putting in extra layers of paperwork that can take a long time certainly can delay you getting to the story. It can international sort of news agendas move on very quickly. It can make it much more difficult for you to get the kind of material you need. Certainly, if you're talking about TV, when you specifically need a lot of footage, you can't work around it really in the same way that you can with print. So I think there's certainly a lot of blocks that governments can create.
We're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sipi, Samira Shackel and Kathleen Burke. And when we return, we will talk about the last major port held by Al-Shabaab, which has fallen to Somali government soldiers and African Union troops.
Spirit, love, energy and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 2023 in Helsinki, 1823 in London and 1323 in New York City. Still with me is Samira Shackel and Kathleen Burke. The fight has been going back and forth between African Union troops and Al-Shabaab in a Somali port town, but now reports say that after being a stronghold for the Al-Qaeda-linked militants for the past 6 years, Somali soldiers have retaken the town of Barawi. Samira, if I start with you this time, the port town we're talking about is a key to bringing arms and fighters from abroad to join the Al-Shabaab forces. And now that the Somali government and African Union have control, how much will this change the dynamics of the fight against Al-Shabaab?
Well, I think it's certainly significant when, you know, strategically important places get taken over. I mean, this happened, I think it was a year or two ago when Kismayo, another major port, was taken back by African Union forces. And there's no doubt that it weakens Al-Shabaab because they generate a huge amount of revenue by controlling ports. So it's not just about foreign fighters coming in. It's also about sort of taxing ships that come in and out and so on. But I think it would be misleading to suggest that this was a sort of fatal blow to Al-Shabaab or anything. I mean, they still control huge swathes of Somalia. They're still, you know, they still are capable of launching attacks in Mogadishu. I mean, the hope is that this was their major base that they were launching lots of attacks in Mogadishu from. But, I mean, there have been a huge amount of terrorist attacks in Somalia over the last year or two. Even Mogadishu, which is supposedly quite secure and under the control of the government, isn't really that secure at all. So I think it's definitely a positive step and a good thing, and hopefully one that will affect revenue sources, which you know has a more significant knock-on effect than other immediate victories. But I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a fatal blow.
Yes, the control of the charcoal trade apparently was which I didn't know there was that part of Somalia is one of the things that losing the port will cost Al-Shabaab.
Do you think this tells us something about the success of African Union forces on a more wider scale in the region?
I hope so. I mean, they've not, shall we say, been the strongest, most dependably successful of peacekeeping forces, to say the least. Indeed, what's also good is the success of the Somalian army, which also gives hope. It's the thing is that that people are almost as scared of government troops as they are of Al-Shabaab, but at least a government troops have some sort of legal basis and some sort of legal restraint, and you can't count on that at all with Al-Shabaab. I agree with Shamira. I mean, it's a very good thing to have happened. It's morale boosting. It's going to help control economics. Mogadishu feels a little bit safer now. But Al-Shabaab goes into the hills and then they come back again. And so I think it's not something that we can see as a, you know, any sort of strong, dependable turning point.
Samira, Al-Shabaab has held control of this port town for the last 6 years, and in that time the place has been under Sharia law and many aspects of modern life have been banned. Can you imagine how this latest military action will change daily life there?
Well, I think Somalia generally is quite traditional. So while some of the stricter elements of the social program might now be relaxed, I think that some of it will probably remain in place because that's often the way that it's worked there. I think in Mogadishu, it's not run by strict Sharia law anymore, but you still do have, I mean, the genders might not be segregated in such a strict way, but you still have sort of modest dress and a sort of religious tone to life. So I think it will, I suppose, be a process of gradual change and a relaxing of those harsher elements. So I think what's quite important to remember, particularly in the context of Somalia, but actually it's also relevant for you know, when you're talking about ISIS in certain areas of Syria, is that often when these jihadist groups take over after a period of serious unrest or civil war, you know, in Somalia this was off the back of 20 years of anarchy, that actually they can initially be quite welcomed by the local population because they're delivering a form of rough justice and order. And while it might be very rough justice, it's still something, and it's sort of allows things to run, allowed people to feel like they're living within a system. And I think that sort of historically, if you look at recent history of jihadist movements, though, what tends to then alienate the local population is these social programs you now have in parts of Iraq and Syria. People, ISIS banning people from smoking because they didn't have cigarettes in the 7th century, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's often what causes people to causes opinions to change, causes people to go against these groups. And perhaps that's something that we'll see there.
We are almost running out of time, but there is one more story I'd like to cover. Let's finally move to Sweden, which has been working hard to promote gender equality. So much so that already a couple of years ago, some Stockholm's nurseries started using a new word, which replaces the gender-specific words he and she, or in Swedish, han and hon. And now the new neutral term, which you can use in every single case, that is hen. again. And now other government agencies are adopting this three-letter word as well, and hen is finding a home in the Swedish dictionary. Kathleen, do you think this move towards using a gender-neutral pronoun should be replicated in other countries too?
I was trying to think how you did that, how you differentiated. I mean, if you want to say a boy or a girl, and you're not allowed to say a boy or a girl, is there a...
I guess you just say hen.
Hen, exactly. But which hen? I understand what's happening, and as a woman, of course, I'm all for gender equality, although I'm not sure gender neutrality is something we ought to worry too much about. But I do sometimes think that there is a boundary where common sense ought to determine certain things, and I must confess that using a new pronoun smacks against that. Of course, makes me entirely a dead thing in Sweden. Of course.
So, Mira, do you think this way of using words actually affects the way we think, even about when it comes to the terms of equality?
I do think that language is massively important. Yeah, I do, and I think I'm sort of inclined to agree with Kathleen, though, that there's a difference to be drawn between gender equality and gender neutrality. But I do think that the thinking behind it is a positive thing, which is that you shouldn't be that one gender shouldn't be inferior to the other, is presumably what I think is about it. Sort of get rid of that level of inequality and from a very, very young age, and get kids to grow up thinking that they're all the same. I would sort of question the wisdom of just completely erasing the differences, though, because some people are men and some people are women, and that's just a fact. There's no value judgment included necessarily in that fact.
Well, what's going to happen if you do it wrongly? What are going to be the sanctions? What are going to be the punishments
if you don't say hen, you say han or hon?
Exactly, or him or her over here, of course. I mean, do you see what I mean? How much is culture? But when is the line going to be drawn?
And one more thing I'm wondering is that if that was to happen in English as well, what would the word be? Any suggestions?
Well, actually, they do. Some transgender communities use a gender-neutral pronoun, but they just use they, which is slightly confusing because it's the plural.
But, and, of course, the French have on, as in on dit.
Yeah.
Exactly. We'll have to leave it there. Samira Shackle and Kathleen Burke, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House again.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
We'll shortly check in with our correspondent in Brazil as the country gears up for runoff election in the quest to elect their new president. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the World News Headlines.
Thank you very much. Dilma Rousseff has won the most votes in Brazil's presidential elections, but will have to win a second runoff poll if she's to serve another term in office. She got around 42% of the vote ahead of the centre-right rival Aécio Neves, who got 34%. A residential area close to Ukraine's Donetsk International Airport has just been hit by return fire from the UK military today. At least one person, said to be a local resident, was killed by the shelling. More than 3,500 people have already died in the conflict, according to the UN. Civil servants in Hong Kong have returned to work at government buildings as pro-democracy protests in the territory subside. Hundreds of demonstrators remain on the streets, but that's far fewer than the thousands seen last week. And workers at Israel's state-owned Haifa port have gone on strike today, shutting one of the major trade gateways over a government plan to build private competing ports. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley, and welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, and 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we head to Rio de Janeiro to catch up with Monocle's Sheena Rossiter, who will no doubt tell us about the fallout from the election at the weekend. Sheena, welcome to the programme. First of all, what is the atmosphere in Rio now after the rather surprising election results?
Hi there. Yes, the feeling before Brazilians even went to the poll was a lot of apathy. A lot of Brazilians are feeling very politically apathetic, so to speak, with actually the elections yesterday registered the most blank or void votes yesterday ever since free and open elections after the dictatorship here in Brazil. And it was a bit of a surprise that the second place candidate who will go to the runoff with Dilma Rousseff was a Ciro Neves, that most Brazilians expected it to be the woman who came in third place, Marina Silva. So that is a bit surprising, and that definitely leaves Brazilians very polarized before they go to the polls again to vote for who will be the president on October 26th, because Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party is seen more as kind of a socialist party in the sense that they have more social programs to help people who are either lower middle class or are now part of the new middle class. And then Ciro Neves is seen more as a pro-business kind of conservative type of candidate. So Brazilians are definitely polarized now on who will be the next vote, and the results simply weren't expected and anything could happen.
What kind of things have people been saying to you when you have been talking to them?
A lot of people have been saying that the Workers' Party, the PT in Portuguese, needs to go. They've been in power for 12 years. They were a party that was created in 1980 by Lula, Luiz Ignacio Lula da Silva, who was a two-term president before Dilma Rousseff. And basically, even though people believed back then that the PT was doing good for Brazil with social programs like Bolsa Família, which helped give funding to underprivileged families, and it did help get some 40 million people out of poverty here in Brazil, but the hopes and promises that the PT did offer to Brazilian people, they weren't all necessarily fulfilled, and especially with the World Cup this past year, a lot of people bought into the belief that the World Cup would offer more than it did, and all the promises that the PT offered to the people were that it would be offer more than it actually did. And now the country is in a technical recession, and people are definitely looking for change. So the alternative might not be what people want with Ciro Neves, but people certainly want Dilma and the Workers' Party out of power.
Could you tell us what is going to be happening next? First of all, how clear is it at the moment who is going to be backing who on the lead up to the second round vote?
That's not exactly clear at the moment. See, Marina Silva, who did come in third place with about 22 million votes, the same amount of votes that she received when she ran for president back in 2010, she hasn't indicated exactly who she will back, if it will be Ciro Neves or Dilma Rousseff. She did indicate, though, in her speech last night that it's more likely to be Ciro Neves and that she will be the king maker in that respect by throwing her 22 million votes behind somebody like Ciro Neves. So it's suspected that things will go that way, and if she does manage to get her voters to go Ciro Neves' way, then there is a good chance that he could actually win and come out and be the country's next president.
And what is the general understanding at the moment? How much corruption has there been when we look at these elections?
The main points of corruption yesterday were coming in polls that were in the country's capital in Brasilia. Obviously, elections in Brazil are never completely without fraud, but in Brasilia, 10 people were arrested. They had not been named, but they were candidates in this election, and they basically had been accused of electoral fraud. And this happened in some cases where people would go to vote, and then it's the machines, which are all 100% electronic here in Brazil, it said that they had already voted. Now, that is a clear problem. So these people essentially couldn't vote, and for some reason, their votes were already cast. So that was definitely a main point, but that was only indicated in Brasilia, and there haven't been any other indications of fraud throughout the country, but that was the main one that was released.
Well, we've been talking about the presidential elections here, but at the same time, there's now a new Congress that has been voted. And what does it look like? What kind of a near future is it going to be for that Congress when it comes to setting laws?
Yes, well, it's definitely a multicultural so-called political rainbow, so to speak, in the sense that there are 28 political parties that are going to make up the Brazilian Congress, regardless of who becomes president. Now, this could potentially breed for another corruption scandal, because with that many political parties at the helm in Congress, it's going to be very difficult for laws and bills to get through Congress with so many clashing political ideologies. And this did lead into Brazil's biggest corruption scandal a few years ago under the Lula administration with the Mensalão scandal. What basically happened there was there were so many different political parties in Congress that Lula's government was supposedly paying monthly allowances to members of different parties in Congress in order to get them to vote their way when an important bill or law was going through. And the Workers' Party, obviously Lula denies all kind of corruption with this scandal, but the idea behind this this Mensalão was in order to get people to vote a certain way because there was just simply too many parties. So we'll see how this plays out come the new year when the new president gets inaugurated in January 2015.
Thank you, Sheena. That was Sheena Rossiter, Monocle's correspondent in Rio de Janeiro. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and up next we look at the lasting impact of a counterculture arts movement.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. From punk graphics to psychedelic posters, from lowbrow to pop surrealism, graphic art and design created its own culture to challenge the establishment of the times. Now, new book out is set to explore the history of this counterculture movement, and co-author of Graphic Art of the Underground, Ian Lowy, crafts it, a visual guide of the past 60 years of images. Welcome to the program. You join us indeed from Manchester. There's quite a lot to cover the six past decades. Why did you decide to start mapping the history starting from the 1950s? I would imagine there has been some underground culture earlier as well.
I'm sure there was. There definitely was underground culture earlier, but we're kind of basing our. I would say the book is based around kind of graphics and rock and roll. Or popular music, but I think that even prior to the advent of rock and roll, we begin with the custom car culture, which began as a form of sort of rebellion immediately prior to rock and roll, and in many ways it was superseded by rock and roll and the Beatles and music, and progressed into the kind of psychedelic scene and beyond into punk, etc. So that's why we've covered that so effectively.
Shall we start straight away with that custom car culture? Yeah. That is something you take a look into on the first chapter of the book. How significant has this phenomenon been, or is it over?
Well, I think there is still sort of there is a worldwide custom car culture that exists. It's quite small in its own right, but I think, you know, across the globe there are car customizers in and car customization scenes in Japan, Australia, throughout the world, really. But the kind of graphics that came out of the custom culture scene, you can see now in that they fed into the lowbrow art scene in California. And you can see it if you go to any rockabilly convention, which is another underground scene, which is worldwide. If you go to any rockabilly convention, you'll see graphics which are originated in custom car culture. So it's very much a sort of a graphic language which is still alive. And I would argue also that the custom car culture as a form of freeform graphics and lettering, etc., is something that later fed into graffiti and street art.
And later on in the book, you take a look into what kind of an effect LSD had on the visual arts scene in the 1960s. Do you think you learned or realised something new about this now, half a century later?
I'm not entirely sure whether we learn something now, other than what I draw upon in the book is very much the kind of links between the psychedelic scene and the punk scene. So what I would see now is the kind of lasting legacy of the kind of psychedelic art scene, in the sense that many of the people who were involved in the psychedelic art scene later popped up in the punk scene, which is something which goes against accepted versions of punk, in the sense that musically it was said to be year zero. But,
how much did they bring with them then when they actually entered that punk scene then later on?
Well, I think in terms of an artist like Jamie Reed, who wasn't really a kind of a psychedelic artist as such, or in any way, shape or form, but he was someone that was studying at art college in 1968 at the height of the kind of student revolts and all of the kind of counterculture consciousness that was going on around there. And that is less so the kind of psychedelic graphics per se, but the political consciousness is something that he brought from that time into the sort of punk movements and the punk graphics.
What other type of milestones of countercultural history would you like to mention here?
Well, I think beyond punk, we've gone into the lowbrow scene, which the lowbrow art scene is something that originated out of, let's say, late 70s Californian punk and also later sort of grunge and Riot Girl scenes. And that's like the sort of psychedelic scene in the 60s. That was also a scene that was born out of artists creating posters for rock bands who were playing in LA or Seattle. So that's a culture that's kind of, or graphic style that's kind of emanated from the streets. And from the music, and yeah.
What do you think about the influence these movements have had? How much have they actually changed the world?
I would say ultimately probably not a great deal. In the sense that I think that the kind of counterculture art it's very difficult to be sort of underground and countercultural in this day and age, because it's bought off by the mainstream so quickly. So that's quite difficult. So I'd say the last hurrah of sort of counterculture or the counterculture ethic or subculture ethic was probably the kind of acid house movement in the late 80s, early 90s, which was crushed by government legislation, etc. But that was probably the last hurrah of the notion that music and style could sort of change things or change the world.
Could you finally look into a crystal ball? What kind of new movements do you expect to see in the near future?
It's very difficult to see, but the crystal ball is a bit cloudy at the moment. But I think that perhaps, who knows, no one could possibly or would necessarily have foreseen the emergence of the designer toy revolution, which is currently pretty big now, in which a lot of artists who are involved in lowbrow art scenes, comics or design, saw 3D vinyl toys as the next stage of the art or visual style.
Thank you very much. That was Ian Lowy, co-author of Graphic Art of the Underground. The book is published by Bloomsbury and it is out now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we just heard about underground culture. So let's stay on that track with The Jam and their song, Going Underground. That was The Jam with Going Underground. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 21:51 in Moscow, 18:51 here in London, and 10:51 a.m. in San Francisco. It's time now for our daily arts review, and today we are joined by journalist Francesca Gavin, who is telling us about the latest on three exhibitions here in London. Welcome to the studio.
Hello.
Shall we? What do you want to start with?
Well, as we are coming up to Frieze, next week is Frieze, obviously all the galleries in London are going a bit crazy with giant shows. So while that's happening, I thought the show currently at Raven Row was a wonderful antidote, which is it's in a great space. It's a non-profit in a beautiful Huguenot building in the middle of Spitalfields. And the show is by K.P. Bremer, who was a German contemporary of Sigmar Polka and Gerhard Richter. And the show's incredible. It's a really, really fascinating take on basically capitalist realism and kind of it was like a post-pop interpretation of capitalism. It's very, very interesting.
Oh yes, it's exciting times in London now when Frieze is almost here, that massive art event that takes over London. What's interesting about this artist Bremer you're talking about, I was doing a bit of my own research, and basically when you look at the art at this exhibition, that's basically about how to visualize capitalism.
Well, yeah, a lot of it's really interesting. It's filled with like graphs and maps and stamps and those kind of the things that are very natural parts of our everyday life, or certainly the everyday life of the 1960s and 70s, which is the majority of the work made from that period. But it's very interesting seeing how you can take something, the language of, say, American pop art, and then put it in a much more political context. And the results are fascinating.
Can you give me examples of some of your favorites you have over there?
Yeah, there was a room filled with overgrown stamps, but even you kind of thought they might have been ideological stamps that he had created, including ones like Never Forget, referencing obviously World War II. And there was some really interesting stuff that were map works, and also just some beautiful film pieces of just good conceptual art. It's a lovely to discover new artists that you wouldn't necessarily know. And if you've got the Sigmar Polka on at the Tate Modern, it's a lovely alternative to see.
That exhibition sounds like a lot of fun. Why is it that this is actually the first solo exhibition of Bremer's work in the UK? And anyway, he passed away already quite a few years ago in 1997.
I think that's something about Raven Row. And actually, I think that's something about the art world. I think we're seeing an increasing desire to rediscover artists from past history in the past 5 years, let's say, internationally. So they're kind of being seen anew. The work in this particular case feels very, very current and referencing our new take on capitalism, say the writings of Mark Fisher, or like the post-Occupy feelings about re-examining how culture's absorbed and politics are taken into art.
Shall we continue to your exhibition suggestion for this week, number two?
Yes. Now, this is completely and utterly different, again, in a non-profit space, which is Ryan Tricarton and Lizzie Fitch, who did an exhibition called Priority Infield, which was their entry into the Venice Biennale in 2013. And it's basically the space has been taken over by these four sort of pod installations, which are very overwhelming, very loud. I mean, they're part video work and part sort of suburban architectural domestic landscapes with teen references in them. And the videos hurt. I mean, Ryan Tricarton stuff is noisy.
What is the general theme for that exhibition? Is there one?
I suppose it sort of sums up the generation who's grown up on the internet. So if you're trying to find like a kind of queer, hyper-televised cultural mess that kind of summarizes our experience of the internet, then I think that this is a perfect example of what that can be.
I think we just have about 2 minutes for the third exhibition.
And well, this is completely different. This is the first time Kerry James Marshall, who's a very respected American painter based in Chicago, he's just been showing in London. This is his first time with David Spurner over here. And the paintings are incredible. We're seeing a lot of abstraction throughout the art world. There'll be a lot of it at Frieze. And seeing something so brilliantly figurative and so intelligently done, recontextualizing African-American identity within an art historical context, I think is incredible.
So what do you actually have there?
I'm hoping paintings, but he also works with collage and photography and sculpture. But you'll definitely be seeing something in some form that's referencing the ideas of African-American identity and the history of art. He's big on history.
It's really interesting. Marshall is well known for his paintings, which depict actual, well, both actual, but also imagined events from African-American history.
Yeah, so there's also some incredible things where he's reinterpreting, say, pastoral paintings. So you'll get like a lovely couple with afros and little hearts around them, sort of reinterpreting the 18th century. Or he's done a lot of very interesting nudes in recent years, which are very confrontational, very much sort of his take on Manet. I think they... I'm a huge fan. I think they're incredible to see in life. Often they're very, very large. And even though they reproduce well, I think he's also had a huge influence on a younger generation of artists, people like Theaster Gates and Rashid Johnson, this whole wave of largely Chicago-based or Chicago-emergent Black American artists.
And when all our listeners are wondering what to do this week, if they would pick one from here, what would be your recommendation for this week?
Well, because I'm in an anti-capitalist mood, I would say K.P. Bremer.
So that was the one from this West, from this artist who spent most of his life in West Berlin and tried to find ways of visualizing what capitalism looks like. And what was your favorite work there?
There's a wonderful video called Walking One, where it literally just depicts someone against the Brandenburg Gate, I think it was, or a big giant Berlin monument, walking towards the screen until they're at a perfect line. It was beautiful.
Amazing. Thank you very much. That was Francesca Gavin, journalist. And that's already all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Samira Shackle and Kathleen Burke, and obviously to Francesca as well. Today's show was produced by Emily Elias and Marika Peters. It was researched by David Pleasant and Alia Mazoud, and our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the news, it's time for Culture with Robert Bound. Jonathan Wheatley will indeed be here with the news in less than 2 minutes. Then at 2200 hours London time, it is the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.